Showtime Sports presents Showtime Boxing with Eric Raskin and Kieran Mulvaney.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Showtime Boxing with Raskin and Mulvaney with my co-host Eric Raskin. I am Kieran Mulvaney. This podcast is being uploaded on the morning of Monday, December 21st, meaning there are just 10 days remaining in the year. Except for us, we are out of here. This is our final podcast of the year. We are bailing on this horror show of 2020. You guys want to stick around for another 10 days? That is up to you. See ya, suckers. Wake us up in 2021. We are out.
Yes. Well, as you know, Kieran, I have undiagnosed narcolepsy. So there's a very real chance I'll begin my 10-day hibernation before we even finish recording this podcast. I might conk out and it's just Showtime Boxing with Mulvaney for the last few minutes of our podcast.
I have a nice soliloquy planned for about 2/3 of the way through the podcast. That would be at least good nap potential for you.
Okay. All right, but, you know, the plan here is not just to nap. It's to be out until the year is over. But, yeah, look, this is just smart strategy. 2020 can't 2020 you anymore if you figure out a way to game the system and make it become 2021 for podcasting purposes a week and a half early. We're basically vaccinating ourselves against whatever remaining awfulness 2020 has to offer. And if the price is one fewer podcast for the listeners, well, too bad. Exactly.
Yes, we're just prepared to suck that up.
Yes.
But we're going to go out with a bang. We have a lot to get to in this final part of the year. We are going to be beating other boxing podcasts to the punch by revealing our 2020 year-end award winners. We will also cover what's been a fairly busy news week, highlighted by the Boxing Hall of Fame's announcement of the class of 2021. We also have Saturday's Showtime triple header to break down. But let's start with the return to the ring of the biggest star in the sport.
And as seems increasingly to be inching toward consensus, the best pound-for-pound fighter in the sport. I'll give my take on that in a bit, and we'll be curious for yours as well, Kieran. But first, let's talk about the fight. We are, of course, talking about Canelo Alvarez, who dominated Callum Smith in front of about 15,000 fans at the Alamo Dome on Saturday night. He couldn't get a knockdown or the knockout, but arguably won every round against the much taller, previously undefeated super middleweight champ. Scores were 119-109, 119-109, and a hard-to-figure 117-111. I was particularly struck early by Canelo's defense. He had no trouble making Smith miss, and soon he was closing the gap. And it just took a couple of rounds before the only drama left in the fight was the question of whether Smith would last the distance. Canelo hit him with every punch imaginable, uppercuts, body shots, right crosses, you name it. The smaller man became the stalker and just completely bossed the bigger man around. Kieran, were you surprised by how easy Canelo made this look? And we've been talking for about a decade, incredibly, about how Canelo improves from fight to fight. Was this the best Canelo performance yet?
It was a remarkable performance to behold, actually, I thought. I mean, there's so often, you know, with the exception of maybe half the rounds or more against Gennady Golovkin, he generally looks, there's this preternatural calm about Canelo in the ring. And I think a large part of that comes from just obsessively detailed preparation and training. I've had the opportunity in the past to take the briefest of peeks behind the curtain of a Canelo camp, and it's just simply relentlessly professional. I think there are no so's prepare and prepare, and Canelo executes and executes. There's no fuss, there's no flash. He's just all business. That's how he is in camp, that's how he is in interviews, and that's how he is in the ring. He's not the fastest man you'll ever see in a boxing ring. He's not the hardest puncher you'll ever see in the boxing ring. He doesn't even necessarily have the most fluid of movements you'll ever see in a boxing ring, but he combines all those attributes into just a phenomenally good package. And I think Saturday night was the perfect example of how a shorter man can use feints and footwork to out-jab a much taller man.
Yeah.
And how, having established that jab, he can then fake and feint it to land power punches with either hand. It was like a casually skillful dominance was the sort of note that I made when I was watching it. And it was just on another level. I mean, I was initially, over the first few rounds, I was a bit disappointed in Smith's showing. I thought it was unadventurous, sort of made poor use of his physical advantages, even though we've known for a while that he doesn't necessarily fight as tall as he should. But by mid-fight, that had kind of shifted to being more of a case of marveling of what Canelo was doing to make Smith look ordinary and unadventurous. You know, and to be fair to Smith, he tore a bicep quite nastily, I think, in round four, and then got it worse in round six. It looked a horrible mess at the end. I didn't think he looked terribly good at the weigh-in, and maybe he does move to 175. But, you know, this was really a case, I thought, of a real ring genius at work. And, you know, you mentioned how we've been talking, like you said, for surely a decade now about how he gets better from fight to fight. And I was thinking to myself watching this, yeah, you know, Floyd Mayweather was incredibly smart to fight this man 7 years ago, you know, before he was fully formed. Because, you know, since then, yeah, look, I mean, just everything has sort of gradually improved and progressively improved. And it all really came together, I think, on Saturday night for, you know, I think you can make a case for it being in many respects the most complete performance of his career, you know. Yeah. The defense, as you said, was just magnificent. I've almost got tired of talking about the defense. I vaguely recall, if I recall correctly, the first time that you and I specifically highlighted his defense in a post-fight pod was the Cotto fight, maybe? We did a post-fight in a locker room somewhere at the MGM.
Right.
Or Mandalay, wherever it was. And I feel like that was the first time we were like, wow, I've really noticed Canelo's defense. And now it's just become an integral part of what he does. And it's also just the way he controls the space. And that's what enables him to have such great defense, because he's able to, no matter whether his opponent is tall or short or aggressive or bigger or stronger or faster, he's somehow just able to get himself at exactly the distance he wants so he can see those punches coming, slip them, and be in the perfect position to fire back. I thought it was a tremendously impressive performance, I must say.
Yeah.
And yeah, look, you mentioned pound for pound. Coming into this fight, after Vasily Lomachenko losing to Teofimo Lopez, you and I both had Terence Crawford at number one. And I think that was the majority opinion. You still participate in the ESPN.com poll in that Crawford had 9 first place votes, Canelo had 3. But there have been that you know, minority of people who have for a while been pushing Canelo as number one. Did this fight change your mind about who is number one pound for pound fighter? Next time you're asked for ESPN, are you still going to put a tick next to Crawford, or are you going to Canelo at this point?
I have been asked. I have sent in my email back to them already as we record this, and I won't beat around the bush with my answer. Yeah. I made the change. Look, pound for pound is supposed to be, regardless of size, who's the best. You know, if you inflated Crawford slightly and you shrunk Canelo slightly and they're both the same natural weight, who do you pick to win? That's supposed to be your answer for who's number one pound for pound. And resume is part of the conversation, but it's secondary. And my gut still tells me, as great as Canelo looked in this fight, that Crawford is slightly, quote unquote, better. But it's gotten really close, closer than it seemed a year ago. And who's the best can only be based on supposition so much. It has to be largely based on evidence. You know, how have you looked in the ring against opposition that can bring out your best, with an emphasis on recent performances? What you did in your last fight or two counts the most. And what you did, say, 5 years ago counts for something, but not as much as what you did 2 years ago, and so forth. All of which is a long way of saying the resume portion of the pound-for-pound picture has tilted so heavily in Canelo's favor that, for me, it outweighs whatever slight talent and ability edges Crawford might still have. You look at the last 3 years, Canelo has faced Gennady Golovkin twice, Daniel Jacobs, Sergey Kovalev, and Callum Smith, plus Rocky Fielding. That one means nothing, but the other 5 all mean quite a lot.
Yeah.
He's currently the man in 2 weight classes, middleweight and super middleweight, and he's near the top at 175.
Yep.
That's pound-for-pound stuff, beating top guys in 3 divisions at once. I was expecting him to beat Callum Smith, but have at least a somewhat tough time doing so, and he made it look easy the way Prime Mayweather and Roy Jones and Pernell Whitaker frequently did when facing similar levels of opposition. Crawford just isn't facing that same caliber of opposition. And, you know, if he was out here right now screaming for Errol Spence, saying he wants that fight next and nothing else matters. Maybe that attitude could buy him a little more time atop my pound-for-pound list, but he isn't doing that. He gives no indication that he wants to challenge himself like Canelo has. So I have been persuaded by this performance to put Canelo at number one, Crawford number two, then Inoue, Spence, Lopez, Lomachenko. All that said, the people barking back at me on Twitter that it isn't even close, there isn't even a conversation, Canelo is number one by a mile. You people need to lay off the Four Loko. Because if you think Canelo lost one or both of his fights to Triple G, now I personally had them both a draw, but the great majority of people believe he lost at least one of those fights, and some people scored the Daniel Jacobs fight against him. You can't tell me it isn't close when Canelo arguably took a couple of L's in the very recent past. Yes, it is close. It is definitely up for debate. There is still a perfectly valid case for Crawford. And if Crawford and Spence do fight, there's a strong likelihood the winner will deserve to be number one. But for now, Canelo is my pound-for-pound champ. What about you, Kieran? I know you don't formally make a list anymore, but who is currently your pound-for-pound king?
No, I think you made really good points there. And I think it is, you know, if also doesn't make sense to say that Canelo is by miles the number one, it's right. Hard to make the case, harder to make the case that he isn't. You know, like you said, let's take the resume portion of it. There's really nobody at the top echelons of the sport, except for Manny Pacquiao, who has anything like as accomplished a list of opponents at this point. Errol Spence is doing very well for himself. He's moving himself right up that list. But you just go on the resume portion alone at this point, and it's Manny and Canelo, really, to this point. And really, over the last 7 years, with the exception of Golovkin, Canelo's basically, since the Arislandi Lara fight, at least, he's really dominated those guys that he's faced. And I think the other key element is that you also touched on. Look, I think that Canelo has for so long been the star of the sport that his actual in-ring skills have almost been a little bit overshadowed, right? You know, that I seem to remember years back we talked about, you know, where, you know, I think when Canelo had sort of asserted himself as the number one in the sport after Floyd's, you know, retirement. And we were talking about, you know, whether the star in the sport was also the number one in the sport. And at that point, we felt that he wasn't, like he was right. The biggest, but he was like number four or number five or something like that. But as you talked about, he's been getting better and better. He is just showing, he's very old school in the way that he keeps adding wrinkles to the fundamentals that he brings in. He's a real throwback fighter in many ways, a willingness to fight top opposition, a willingness to go into various weight divisions, just the way he's consistently improving his technical abilities. So, yeah, I think you summed it up very well, that there is so little a gap right now in terms of in-ring performances and in-ring skills, and such a large gap in terms of resume, that it's hard to make the case that it isn't Canelo right now. I agree with you. And look, based on the interview with Errol Spence that Mannix did during the DAZN broadcast and right. Terence Crawford's response to that on social media, we probably shouldn't be holding our breath for that Spence Crawford showdown at the moment. So. Yeah. So it's hard to see that resume gap. You know, obviously it's all posturing at the moment, but still, that resume gap is still there. And the way Canelo is going, it's hard to imagine that he can continue to improve, but he hasn't stopped improving from fight to fight yet.
Right,
so
right.
Maybe we still haven't even seen the best of the man. I think it's an increasingly impressive career. I'm just very impressed with the way he goes about his business.
Yep.
But you know, you mentioned this, right? If Canelo really is number one, even if at the very worst now he's 1A, does this mean we should actually prompt a little bit of a rethink of the positioning of a guy who a lot have been willing to throw overboard? That man who you mentioned went 0-1-1 against Canelo, arguably should have gone no worse than how you had it, 0-0-2, probably should have taken at least one win, and that's of course Gennady Golovkin. On Friday, the night before Canelo beat Smith, Golovkin scored 4 knockdowns in 7 rounds to really easily dispatch mandatory challenger Camille Serramatta, the referee stopping it between rounds 7 and 8. Golovkin's 38 years old. It was his first fight since that razor close win over Sergey Derevyanchenko 14 months ago. We were looking for signs as to what he had left. Were any of your questions in that regard answered by watching that fight?
Let's go!
It's the most all-star studded challenge ever. And this time, it's every competitor for themselves.
Best challenge ever!
The Challenge All-Stars. New season now streaming on Paramount Plus. Go to ParamountPlus.com to try it free. Terms apply.
From the world of Sonic the Hedgehog, a new hero arrives.
I am
ready. Is there anyone stronger?
No.
Tougher?
No.
Funnier?
I do not make jokes. I make warriors.
Knuckles, April 26th on Paramount Plus.
Yes!
Not totally. We got some information, but nothing definitive. Zeremata just isn't very good. What a joke that some alphabet body says, you have to fight this guy or you lose your title. That's ridiculous. Zeremata had beaten no contenders himself. He just isn't world class. He's somewhere in that range of 2016 Dominic Wade and 2014 yes. Marco Antonio Rubio. And you remember what 2016 and 2014 Triple G did to those guys?
Yeah.
Those were second round KOs. I think prime Triple G stopped Zeremeta in two rounds, maybe three tops. So the question here is Golovkin that far removed from his prime? Or was he intentionally carrying Zeremeta to get some rounds in? I think it's probably a bit of both. He's not washed, obviously. I am, and my whole timeline is full of people celebrating this fight starting at 8:30 p.m. on a Friday. We're all washed, but Golovkin is not. He's aging, fading, but not washed. He looked good in this fight. I wouldn't say he looked great. The power is still mostly there. The jab looks good, some solid body work. But you can only learn so much when the guy in front of you provides no real resistance. I'd say, you know, I hate when people do this, like estimating percentages type thing, but I'm going to do it anyway. I'd say we're looking at something like 85% of prime Triple G. But it's impossible to know for sure off this fight. I think the Derevyanchenko fight was much more telling. How about you? How good do you believe Triple G is right now? And as we've discussed, Canelo is a promotional free agent, a network free agent. He has a lot of options regarding where to go and what to do next. But certainly a third fight with Golovkin is going to be on the table. Off these two performances that they both just had this weekend, scale of 1 to 10, how interested are you in that trilogy fight for the first half of 2021?
So my thought about Golovkin and how he looked is not at all dissimilar to yours. It's very difficult to tell. He's going to look better against, like you said, a Kamaru Zeremeta than a Sergey Derevyanchenko. I remember before he fought Derevyanchenko, when we were previewing that fight, you said something to the effect of this will be a great measuring stick because it will show us how he does against a guy who's good, but not on that, you know, Jacobs Canelo kind of level.
Right.
Derevyanchenko might actually be a little bit better than we thought going into that fight, as I think he emphasized with his performance against Jamal Charlo. Zeremeta is perhaps a little bit worse, like you said. But I just, you know, going on the eye test, I thought physically he looked better than he's looked for a little while. I thought he looked lean and strong. He seemed lighter on his feet than he's done in a while. His defense was better than I remember it being for even longer. He actually, like, committed to the defense a little bit, which he hasn't done very much. He decided to move his head in there a lot more than he has done. That might just be a consequence of being able to do that because Zeremeta's punches weren't particularly fast. He could see everything coming. He looked like he was very relaxed in there, that he was perfectly happy to keep going until he got rid of him. But I agree with you that a few years ago, he wouldn't have had to wait. The first or second punch that he dropped him with would have probably been the end of it. It looks to me as if, and we talked about this with Anthony Joshua the other week, that he's continuing a transitional style as he ages. That I think he's already shown us in previous fights that there's a little bit less of emphasis on the body punch. The jab that was always very important and that everything fed off on is become increasingly important as a part of his arsenal. And I think we've seen that for a few years now. And that I think we're going to see less as he goes on of that single punch concussive just getting people the hell out of there to being more of a methodical, thumping them, weakening them with the jab, and just slowly taking the life out of them kind of a fight. And I think that's going to be more of what we're going to see from Gennady over the final couple of years of his career. As for like the Canelo matchup, look, like a lot of folks in boxing, I tend to overreact to what I've just seen.
Right.
So in a sense, I'm more enthusiastic. So my initial response was, oh my God, I'm much more enthusiastic about a third fight now than I was. And then when you look at Canelo and what he did, and in the cold light of day, how competitive would a third fight really be? Look, Canelo looked a freaking monster at 168. That's the other thing we didn't talk about. He's physically big now.
Yeah.
Given his proclivity for taking advantage of being the A-side, which he is perfectly entitled to do, I can't see Canelo saying, you know what, I'll go down to Gennady's level. He's going to make him come up to 168. And I think he's going to have substantial advantages over him there, Canelo. And as good as Golovkin looked, I thought Canelo looked better at just about every aspect of his fight against a superior opponent. All of that said, if fans are allowed back in substantial numbers by May 8th next year, I suspect, for the reasons we talked about last week, like, you know, this is the one opportunity for him to get a huge amount of money from DAZN and so on and so forth, that a third Golovkin bout will be next. I think that Golovkin did what we talked last week about him needing to do. He looked lively. He looked good. He scored an impressive, dominating win, but not suddenly so impressive and dominant that it looked as if the old Triple G was back and Canelo might think, I'll wait another year for that third fight. I think he just threaded that needle, intentionally or not, just well enough to put him in line to be next for Canelo. I do think if crowds are back, if we're recovering from the pandemic, I think probably a third fight now at 168 would probably be the most likely thing for Canelo. But if it isn't, who do you most want to see Canelo fight?
Gotta be Artur Beterbiev. That's the dream fight for the hardcore fans. that's the correct response, to quietly say to yourself, oh my goodness. Canelo is operating at such a high level right now that I'm not sure there's anyone at 160 or 168 who really poses a serious threat to him. You know, Caleb Plant is good, but maybe Canelo walks right through him like he did Callum Smith. You're absolutely right that Canelo against Golovkin is an event that makes a lot of sense. I hadn't thought about the weight aspect of it, but you might be right that actually makes it more complicated. Neither of these guys likes the other and will want to concede too much in that negotiation. So that gets a little tricky, but let's say it does get signed. I don't think Golovkin is competitive with Canelo at this point. Jermall Charlo is probably the best challenge at 160. You also have Andrade there. You have Bivol at 175. These are all solid fights. But Canelo versus Beterbiev, that would be something special. Pretty close to even money, in my view. I remember right after Beterbiev scored his big win to claim the title there, that we were first starting to talk about this fight and felt like Canelo would be a bit of an underdog there, although certainly a live one. I don't know that he's an underdog anymore. I think it's pretty close to even. We'll have plenty of time to talk about it in the weeks and months ahead, you know, after we sleep through the rest of 2020. But that is the fight to me.
Yeah. Yeah. That's let's just end this podcast now. That's not going to get any better.
All right, see you in 2021, folks.
I got sweet dreams to see me through the end of 2020 now, so there you go. But while Canelo and Golovkin obviously got most of the attention this weekend, and deservedly so, there was also a Showtime triple header on Saturday night. It looked appealing, at least on paper, before heads started clashing and Mohegan Sun bubble judges started getting involved. So the main event, as we talked about, it was a replacement fight for a replacement fight. After first Nordin Ubali and then Nonito Donaire fell out, it was a bantamweight clash between Emmanuel Rodriguez and Raymark Caballo. Looked like a promising star matchup, as we talked about last week. In the event, Rodriguez boxed cautiously. The untested Caballo had trouble catching up to him. At the end of 12 rounds, it looked as if, you know, Rodriguez had wrapped up a dull decision win, and we wouldn't have much to say about it. Showtime scorer Steve Farhood had a 118-110 for Rodriguez, which seemed about right. And one of the judges, David Sutherland, had Rodriguez also winning 118-110. But John McKay had Caballo up 115-113, which was a but Dom Trella had it 116-112, making Caballo a split decision winner. Eric, how did you have it? I hate that we keep having to ask this question, but what do you make of the scorecards? Do you have any interest on, based on what we saw, in seeing either of these guys on Showtime again in 2021?
So I scored it 9-3, 117-111. I don't mind anyone who scored it a little closer. Rodriguez was clearly outboxing Caballo in most of the early rounds, but he wasn't opening up, wasn't really going after him. And in the second half of the fight, there were a lot of rounds where he wasn't doing much. He was moving and being purely defensive. And when he would land a good punch that knocked Caballo off balance, he never pounced and followed up as he should have. So to a great extent, he has himself to blame for the result. He was clearly the superior boxer. Caballo was outclassed, wasn't quite ready for this step up. And Rodriguez let him win some of the later rounds and make the fight closer than it should have been. But no way in hell did Caballo win 7 or 8 rounds as those two judges had it. Even 6 rounds seems impossible to me. That is atrocious judging. And I want to single out Don Trella, who had it 8-4 and gave 5 of the first 6 rounds to Caballo.
Really?
Yes. His scorecard was posted online, and I don't know how that is possible. That means you're just scoring based on who's throwing more punches, and you're completely ignoring what's landing and what's effective. I'm not going to mince words. I'm left to assume Don Trella doesn't know how to score a boxing match. That scorecard, the way he got to 116-112, it really pisses me off. These are fighters' livelihoods. Yep. Rodriguez, as frustrating as his poor performance was, he doesn't deserve this loss on his record. And we've seen some awful scorecards in the bubble. I think all these fights at Mohegan Sun have exposed that Connecticut needs to revamp its pool of judges, because several of them have proven not up to the task. This scorecard from Trella, giving rounds to Caballo early in the fight when he was being taken to school, that's as bad a scorecard as any of them.
Paramount Plus and the National Park Foundation present A Mountain of Zen. Are you still listening? Good. Take a deep breath. You needed a break. This Earth Week, you can live stream 7 national parks for 7 days on Paramount Plus. So, yes, you can literally stream a stream. Paramount Plus, official streaming partner of the National Park Foundation.
As for the fighters and whether I want to see them again, I don't know. Caballo is pretty raw and pretty limited. I don't mind seeing him again, but I can't get too excited about his prospects as a serious future contender. And Rodriguez, he's clearly a capable fighter, but he has some thinking to do. The cautious way he fought, that gives me reason to believe he isn't over getting knocked out by Inoue.
Yeah, could be.
So there were 2 undercard fights on this card, and they were disappointing in a different way. And there were some obvious common threads between them, so let's address them together here. In the show opener between bantamweight southpaws, unbeaten prospect Gary Antonio Russell had built a lead over veteran former titleist Juan Carlos Payano when the fight was stopped after the 6th round due to damage suffered by Payano from a clash of heads. The cut didn't look like much at all. I could barely see it on TV, and it wasn't actively bleeding, but the ringside doctor said he could see the nerves around Payano's eye, and that's why he stopped it. Lucky for Tyson Fury, he didn't have this particular doctor in his fight with Otto Wallin. Anyway, they went to the cards, and Russell won a technical decision, 59-55 twice and 58-56. It was an ugly, sloppy fight to that point. I had Russell up 58-56, but it was all rather inconclusive. Then in the next fight, welterweight mega prospect Jaron Boots Ennis was battering veteran Chris Van Eerden spectacularly for about 2 minutes before their heads came together violently, and Van Eerden's forehead looked like someone had taken a divot out of it with a 9-iron. The fight was stopped. No need for any explanation from any doctor as to why, and it was ruled a no decision. Kieran, what if anything, did we learn about up-and-comers Russell and Ennis in these aborted bouts?
Well, we learned more about Russell because we saw more of him on Saturday and had seen less of him previously. I was reasonably impressed because we didn't know going in what we were going to see with Russell, given that it was such a step up in caliber of opposition against a guy in Piano who's been there and fought the very best folks recently with very good records and been winning or been losing very close against them. Piano just fought. He was clearly fighting that kind of fight that, oh my goodness, it's an absolute nightmare for an up-and-coming fighter to fight. But God, it's like one of those things you've got to get through on your way to that. You've got to like see if you can handle this kind of a guy. And he was handling him. He wasn't completely dominating him, but I thought he was comfortably ahead. I think your scorecard sounds just fine. You know, it felt as if we can't know, but it did feel as if we were heading towards a Russell Point win. But I think we learned enough to determine that, you know, he looks like he might not be quite at the skill level of his brother, although it's again hard to say against such a scrappy opponent as that. But I think we learned enough to determine that, you know, he's a legitimate prospect and he's worthy of being seen again, and he's got that Russell family calmness in the ring under pressure, and he's definitely got that physical ability in those fast hands. I'd be very happy to see him again, and also I just kind of smile just seeing Big Brother in the corner. Well, there's just something, I don't know, there's just something very nice about that family that I just kind of like. I like that. As for Ennis, I picked him to win by, I think, 9th round stoppage. You picked him to win in 5. I'm not sure the fight was going to go that far.
Right.
We can't know for certain, but this felt as if it was en route to a blowout, which would have been very impressive had that happened. Look, Ennis is so strong. He's so skilled. But we know that anyway.
Yeah.
We didn't get a chance. I would have loved to have seen him have the opportunity to show how good he was by getting Van Heerden out of there, which it certainly looked early on as if that might well have been the case. Van Heerden looked very uncomfortable early on from that assault. Obviously frustrating for both of them, not least for Van Heerden, who had been out the ring for 16 months before this, returns home with only 3/4 of his head. You know, but I think when we come back, we'll probably see Ennis stepping up another level in opposition. This would have been a good, decent fight. Obviously, it wasn't the originally planned opponent. It was as good a replacement as you could have expected in the circumstances. But, I mean, the fact that a fight can end like this just shows that there comes a point where you just don't want to waste too much time working your way up. Ennis is the goods. Let's see him up against some real quality opposition now. Let's see him pushing towards a title fight, I think. So, this gets the uncomfortable part of the podcast coming up here.
For some.
Well, you see, officially, this card wraps up our picks competition for the year. Here is the alleged final score that the mainstream liberal media is trying to force us to accept. Eric, going into this, was allegedly leading 63-52. We both picked Rodriguez to stop Caballo and got no points there. We both picked Ennis to stop Van Heerden, as I mentioned. There was nothing either of us could have done differently to get any points there. In the opener, Eric had Piano by split decision. I had Russell KO 10. So I picked up 1 point. Making the proclaimed final score 63-53. All I know is this. Heading into the shutdown, I had a comfortable lead. Everyone was saying that I was clearly going to win it. It was just, you just look at the available odds and I was clearly going to win. Coming out of it, suddenly Eric starts getting these points from nowhere. Then somehow Charles Conwell broke Wendy Toussaint's nose at exactly the right moment of their fight. And then, with me poised to make my final strike on the final day, we get 2 headbutts and a ridiculous decision. I think we know what's going on here. I have hired the very best lawyer, Mr. Lionel Hutz, to prove my case. I am confident of victory.
Do I see black oil leaking from Lionel Hutz's brow right now? Is that what I see? I've said it before, and I'll say it again, Kieran. I won the final 5 years of Ring Theory picks over Detloff. I just beat you for the second year in a row. There is no shame at all in being the Barkley to my Jordan, the Venus to my Serena, the Stones to my Beatles. There can only be one GOAT. You know, sometimes you just come along at the wrong time in the wrong era against a generational talent who simply can't be beaten. So
the sad reality is I'm actually the Nate Robinson to your Jake Paul.
I don't want to be Jake Paul in any analogy. I really liked being Jordan Serena Beatles. Can we go back to that one?
I don't think so.
All right. Well, in any case, the point is, Kieran, don't get discouraged. There's not a whole lot you can do. It's not you. It's me.
It's all right. No, it's just the media.
All right. We will let that part of the podcasting year end. And we're, in fact, finished talking about the final major fight weekend of 2020. With all due respect to David Morrell Jr. and Mike Gavronsky, who are headlining a Fox card the day after Christmas, the year is effectively over from a fight perspective. So let's hand out some awards from the very best of what we saw in the ring this year. It was, of course, a strange year in the world overall, but it trickled down to boxing and made for a strange year in our sport. There were no fights at all for about 3 months, and when fights returned, they were mostly B-level and C-level fights for a couple of months as things ramped back up. So the selection for the year-end awards is skimpier than in most years, but we actually still ended up with at least one or two worthy candidates in every category. You know, from the winners alone, I don't think you'd be able to tell that we only had about 75% of a year to choose from. Anyway, I will get it started with my pick for Round of the Year. That's our first award, Round of the Year, and there were a few outstanding rounds to choose from. You're going to be hearing the names Jose Zepeda and Ivan Brancic a lot during this award segment. I think rounds 2 and 5 of their fight were both among the best of the year, both featuring both fighters on the canvas. The 6th and final round of Gervonta Davis versus Leo Santa Cruz was spectacular. Just 2 weeks ago on Showtime, we saw a great round, round 9 of Chris Colbert versus Jaime Arboleda. I might be forgetting some others, but for me, the winner in a close call is the second round of Zepeda-Brancic. One knockdown apiece, plus another knockdown Zepeda scored that Kenny Bayless missed, and just generally wild, nonstop action for the whole 3 minutes, more consistent than any other round in that fight. So that's my pick. What's your pick, Kieran?
Yep, I certainly hear you in that. And certainly in terms of just stuff happening in terms of totally crazy, good God, am I really watching this? I think, as you mentioned, that fight is going to be up front with a lot of these categories. I am going to go a slightly different route. My round didn't have the epic swings back and forth, didn't have those sort of multiple holy shit moments, although it did end with one. I'm going to pick, you've already mentioned it, round 6 of Gervonta Davis, Leo Santa Cruz on Showtime pay-per-view. Santa Cruz has started strongly in the fight, had been more aggressive than maybe Davis expected, but Davis had asserted himself over the next three. He was in control of the fight as they entered the 6th, but Santa Cruz came right back at him, firing straight punches to Davis's face, digging him with body shots and uppercuts. Davis came back strongly, ripping into him with body shots and uppercuts of his own. You know, then Santa Cruz started to close Gervonta's right eye. Davis looked like he'd repelled the assault. Santa Cruz drove him back across the ring. It was arguably the best quality round of a genuinely high quality contest. It was probably the best round Santa Cruz had in the fight up until the point where it wasn't.
Right.
And that point where it wasn't wins my next award, he says with a wonderful segue, for KO of the year. There are several contenders for this category, most notably probably Alexander Povetkin's over Dillian White. And if you pick that one, I certainly won't blame you. Showtime had another strong contender with Joe George's knockout of Marcus Escudero, which, like Povetkin White, and indeed like Davis Santa Cruz, was part of the great year of the uppercut. 2020 was. The thing I especially loved, though, about the Davis Santa Cruz KO was something that we talked about in the podcast afterwards. And honestly, I didn't even notice until Davis himself tweeted about it. In the moment, watching it, it was a viscerally satisfying knockout, a punch of absolute beauty that Davis had been looking to land from the moment the first bell rang. And it immediately had us all doing that universal boxing, oh, that we see when there's that perfect knockout. But I did appreciate it all the more when I saw the sequence as Davis himself tweeted it out. Right. Santa Cruz throws a right hand. It hits Davis. He throws another. Davis parries it. He throws a third. Davis knows it's coming, slips underneath it to his left. And then with that Santa Cruz right hand kind of blocking Leo's vision, bam, launches that left uppercut to send Santa Cruz instantly out cold. I thought it was absolutely fabulous. But like I said, some really good contenders out there. What do you reckon? You with me on this one, though?
I am. We have the same pick. I think the only other runner-up I would mention that I don't believe you mentioned is Zepeda Brancic. It has to be mentioned. Yeah. That was it's hard to beat the drama of that knockout. What an amazing year of big knockouts and certainly uppercut knockouts, especially given the fact that we missed a quarter or so of the year. But yeah, in the end, Davis Santa Cruz has to be the pick. Perfect punch, elite opponent, high stakes, big pay-per-view main event. Santa Cruz totally down and out. That always helps when it's not, it doesn't end with a guy right. Sort of almost getting up. I mean, he was out. All the ingredients were there in this one. Next, we have upset of the year. And I guess the most high profile upset of the year was Teofimo Lopez over Vasily Lomachenko. But it really wasn't that big an upset. We all knew Lopez was a very live dog. I think the two biggest upsets both came pre-shutdown. Back in January, it's hard to believe that this was this year, but in January, Jason Rosario stopped Julian J-Rock Williams. That was a big shocker. And then in March in Brooklyn, just before the world stopped turning, Robert Hellenius KO for Adam Kownacki. I had forgotten how wide the odds were on that fight. Looked it up. Kownacki was as much as a minus 2,500 favorite, and you could get plus 900 on Hellenius as the underdog. That's basically as wide as the first Ruiz Joshua fight. And so that's the one that I'm picking. Despite the fact that I never believed all that much in Kownacki, I'm just thinking in terms of the public perception of this fight, it was supposed to be a cakewalk, and certainly Hellenius seemed washed years ago. I knew that Kownacki was nothing special, but I didn't think 36-year-old Robert Hellenius, who had been stopped a couple of fights earlier by Gerald Washington, would be the guy to beat him. Kieran, agree or disagree with my pick?
First thing I got to say, one point that I agree with was I could not believe that those fights were not in 2019. holy crap, this has been a long ass year. I'm going to go with the other one. Okay. I am going to go with Rosario J-Rock. I get what you're saying with your pick. And obviously, you know, Rosario was, particularly at that time, a better quality seemingly opponent than Hellenius. So you'd think it would be less of an upset. But at the same time, Adam Kownacki was no J-Rock Williams either. Right. And J-Rock, and I think what's key to this was that he was riding high on the back of his own upset win over Jarrett Hurd, which really was in 2019, I think, right? Probably. That was
that sounds right. Sounds right.
I can't even tell anymore. I'm like a dog. I can't tell if something happened last week or in 2016. I have no idea. And really, you know, after the first round, which was quite even, Rosario really, he just didn't let Williams into this fight. Like, he progressively discouraged Williams as the fight went on, and especially after he caused J-Rock's left eye to swell, and just it looked like J-Rock just couldn't handle it at all. And then, you know, Rosario turning it up in the fifth, and Williams just flat out wilted. It really shook up that junior middleweight division, at least until Rosario met Jermell Charlo on Showtime pay-per-view 9 months later. But yeah, I totally get your pick, but I'm going to go with Rosario over Williams for my upset that apparently happened this year.
Fair enough. That's it's not a lot between those two, in my view.
No, indeed. But, you know, while both of those were decent fights, neither were anywhere near being contenders for Fight of the Year, which is our next award. Like you said, despite the fact that we only had 9 months or so of fights to choose from, and really 6 months of A-level fights, boy, there are some really, really good fights. The recent rematch between Juan Francisco Estrada and Carlos Quadras was just exceptionally high quality. More recently than that, Masayoshi Nakatani's comeback win over Felix Verdejo that we talked about last week, cracking fight. On Showtime pay-per-view, I think Jamal Charlo's win over Sergey Derevianchenko was a strong contender for Fight of the Year for a little while there. Davis Santa Cruz that we talked about was a cracker. I must be missing some. But there can really be only one winner this year. In any other year, all those guys would be in with a good shot. It has to be Zepeda Brancic. Good God, what a five rounds of absolute control chaos. If somehow you have forgotten the basic parameters of how this fight unfolded, Brancic dropped Zepeda twice in the first round. Zepeda returned the favor in the second, but then Brancic dropped Zepeda again. Then Zepeda dropped Brancic once in the third and once in the fourth. So Entering the fifth round, each man had been down three times. Only the ropes held up Zepeda after Baranchik punched in the fifth. So that was 4-3 in knockdowns. But in the eighth total knockdown, equalizing the total number, that was the decisive one. Zepeda folding Baranchik in half and leaving him out cold for several minutes. It's a weird fight of the year in that it's not one that you would look at and talk about the quality of the fight of the year. But in terms of absolute batshit craziness, what the hell am I watching? What's going to happen next? Mm-hmm. It's fight of the year by a country mile. I know you're with me on this one.
Yeah, I am. This has to be the pick. This is the easiest category this year of all the ones that we're doing. Yeah, I mean, this is a fight that I think we're going to be talking about for many years to come. Four knockdowns apiece in five rounds. That just doesn't happen. It's one of those fights that if it happened in a boxing movie, you'd say it was completely unrealistic. Exactly. Rewrite it. Make it more believable. So, yeah, this is the easy winner for Fight of the Year. And that brings us to the final award, Fighter of the Year. This is pretty clearly, I'd say, a two-man race. And as we discussed with Brian Campbell a few weeks ago, you normally don't want to give it to someone who only fought once during the year in question. But hashtag 2020, not much choice here. The top two are undoubtedly Tyson Fury, for paying off Mark Breland to get the stoppage win against Deontay Wilder, and Teofimo Lopez for outpointing Vasily Lomachenko. Some decent honorable mentions. No, we don't have Clay Collard to include among them, but we do have Errol Spence, who, if we did a comeback fighter of the year, I think he's in that conversation, mm-hmm. probably along with Chocolatito Gonzalez, I'd say. Also, Gervonta Davis is in the mix. Both Charlos had good years. Emmanuel Navarrete. I think I'll squeeze Canelo in there at the last minute off that performance. And, of course, for being the king of quarantine, Joseph Parker has to get a mention. But one and two, in some order, are Fury and Lopez. My order is Fury number two, Lopez number one, mostly because, well, he beat Vasily Lomachenko. Nothing against Deontay Wilder, but there's just no comparison in terms of quality of the boxer defeated. I disagree with Joe Goosen and anyone else who scored it a draw. I think Lopez definitely won, even though it was very close. He fought a great 12th round and won that round clearly, in my view, to put an exclamation point on the victory. For a 23-year-old to step up like he did and win that fight and outbox for much of the bout that opponent, no doubt in my mind, Teofimo Lopez, despite sporting just a 1-0 record on the year, is the fighter of the year. I assume it's between Lopez and Fury for you also. So who you got, Kieran?
It is also between them. And while for a substantial part of the year, it was Tyson Fury's award to lose, in the end, I have to give it to Teofimo Lopez. Look, Fury's was a hugely impressive win over a man who damn nearly knocked him out when last they met. And the sheer dominance of it was significant and earns him extra points. But I cannot reasonably spend several years pitching Vasily Lomachenko as the best boxer, not just on this planet, but on all known planets, right, and then not reward the guy who beat him and beat him well. The only other time Lomachenko lost as a pro was in his second fight against a veteran world champion who didn't make weight and spent half the fight punching him in the gonads. And even then, Lomachenko came back strong and nearly won it down the stretch. And, you know, in comparison, I thought Lopez was a very obvious and very clear winner. Yes, once Lomachenko got going in the second half of the fight, he closed it down considerably. But I made the same point here that you just made. What sealed the win, seals his treasured Showtime Boxing with Raskin and Mulvaney Fighter of the Year award, was that 12th round. The fact that he stood and traded and won that final frame against the pound-for-pound number one, who is coming back strong, to leave absolutely no doubt as to who won, except apparently, as we shall talk about later, in the mind of Vasily Lomachenko. Yeah, no, Teofimo Lopez absolutely deserves that. I have a suspicion that it will not be the only time he wins Fighter of the Year award either.
Yeah, that's a reasonable suspicion. So, all right. So we're in agreement on that one. And by the way, our longtime listeners might recall that on the HBO podcast, we used to name a podcast guest of the year. We forgot to do that in 2019 in our first year with Showtime. We're bringing it back here. So now the Showtime Boxing with Raskin and Mulvaney 2020 podcast guest of the year. And what do you know? It's a tie. A tie between Steven Espinoza, Mauro Ranallo, Steve Farhood, Al Bernstein, Gordon Hall, Abner Morris, Raul Marquez, Barry Tompkins, and Brian Custer. Crazy how that shook out. Congratulations to all the co-winners.
That's right. But if there were to be a tiebreak, it's Steven Espinoza, because it's always going to be Steven Espinoza.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah. All right. If you're listening, Steven, right now, you won. Congratulations. If any of the other guys are listening, we'll send you a separate podcast with a different different ending. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. And you all know what it's about. All right. So you just actually named quite a few Hall of Famers and future Hall of Famers in that list. And shortly, we will wrap up the show by discussing the 2021 Hall of Fame class. But first, some news here. Vasily Lomachenko got some attention late in the week with an interview he took part in which he commented on the scoring in his fight with Teofimo Lopez. As you just talked about, one of the scorecards was too wide, but most observers agreed with the result, or, you know, at best scored it a draw. Lomachenko apparently sees things entirely differently, Eric. He said, "It's about being bribed. There is nothing honest about the judging. I don't know whose game it was. I do think it was someone's game." Well, what do we think about that?
It's weird how often boxers turn to the conspiracy theories.
Yep.
Elsewhere in that interview, I think, if I'm interpreting him correctly, and it was somewhat broken English, but I think he was saying that he has watched the fight and he scored it a draw. I think that's what he said. That's fine. If he had just said that, if he had said it should have been a draw, the scorecards all sucked, especially that one Julie Letterman was watching a different fight or had her filled out her scorecard in advance. If he'd said something like that, I think it would have been fine. But you cross over into directly accusing someone of taking a bribe. Julie Letterman has been doing this a long time and has a good reputation. Seems very unlikely to me. Plus, if you have been bribed, once you have Lopez up 7-0 or whatever, and Lomachenko is having some good rounds in the second half, wouldn't you give him a few of those to make it look good? No, she just had a bad night and didn't appreciate what Loma was doing in spots, and she handed in a pretty bad scorecard. I'm bothered by what Lomachenko said here. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as of now, one bitching and moaning excuse-filled interview, he still has a ways to go to catch Deontay Wilder. But look at those two together. It's all a very potent reminder that these are elite athletes, and when you get used to winning, it can be very hard to accept losing. This is one loss I think Lomachenko really needs to accept and learn from if he wants to have any hope of winning a rematch.
Yeah.
In other news, there were several fight announcements over the past week. Let me run through them all quickly. The Miguel Burchelt-Oscar Valdez fight we're all looking forward to, which was postponed by COVID, has a new date, February 20th. A fight we're similarly excited for, Roman Choclatito Gonzalez versus Juan Francisco Estrada 2, is signed for March 13th. January 30th will be a busy day. As we've learned, Caleb Plant will meet Caleb Truax in the biggest all-Caleb fight in boxing history. And in Russia on the same day, both Artur Beterbiev and Sergey Kovalev will be in action. And some Showtime news for January. The first Showbox card of 2021 has been announced, a quadruple header taking place in the Mohegan Sun bubble on January 20th. And 3 days later, January 23rd, the rescheduled showdown between Stephen Fulton and Angelo Leo. I'm pumped for that. Kieran, anything quick to say about any of these fights?
Yeah, just that 2021 is already definitively better than 2020, assuming these all come off. Fulton Leo and Choclatito Estrada alone. Again, another reason to just go to sleep and wake up next year, because what a fantastic start to the year. And I'm actually really looking forward to the Caleb Bowl, too, actually. That'll... And of course, Burchelt Valdez, like you said, we've been looking forward to that for a long time. That's a tremendous start to the year. Let us hope that the pandemic and other things allow all those to happen. We also shouldn't forget the previously announced and secured first big fight of the year. And because we won't be here next week, because of the whole sleeping thing, let's give it a quick preview now. It is, of course, the January 2nd title eliminator tilt between Ryan Garcia and Luke Campbell. We've talked about it before. We set it up, but we should, you know, touch on it one more time. Very quickly, Eric, how do you see that going?
So I looked up the odds. They're interesting. Garcia is about a minus 300 favorite. Campbell is like a plus 230 underdog. That actually seems just about right to me. I favor Garcia, and I have a tough time betting either side at those prices. It's a big step up for King Rai, a real test for him, a test he certainly could fail. But I like what I've seen from him lately. I think he will pass, and my gut is telling me he lands some big shots and actually takes Campbell out in the later rounds. How about you?
Very similar. Look, Luke Campbell's a legitimately very good fighter. He's tall, he's awkward, he's skilled. But the available evidence we now have, like enough statistically significant sample to suggest that he is good enough to fall just short against the very best. And while it's too early to say that Garcia is the very best, he's clearly a legitimate talent. He's another one who seems to be improving constantly. I think he's got too much speed, too much power for Campbell. I think that maybe Campbell will start out well. You know, he'll have the experience. Maybe there'll be some things for Garcia to try to figure out. Campbell might even be ahead on points after a few rounds. But I do think that Garcia will get into his stride. I could see a unanimous decision win for him, or I can also see something like an 11th round stoppage win after the punishment just starts accumulating. This could be a very significant fight for Ryan Garcia. We will talk about it in our first podcast of next year. But let's wrap up 2020 with the big news of the week. The International Boxing Hall of Fame announced its class of 2021, and as expected, it is going to be star-studded. The holdovers from the class of 2020 in the modern category, Bernard Hopkins, Juan Manuel Marquez, and Shane Mosley, they will be joined in June if induction weekend can go forward next year. And God, if it can't by June 2021, then good Lord. They will be joined by Floyd Mayweather, Vladimir Klitschko, and Andre Ward. What a half dozen. Those were the top three vote getters this year. Nobody else got over the 80% threshold. So the other two first ballot nominees, Miguel Cotto and James Toney, will have to wait. I have a couple of thoughts on Cotto, unsurprisingly. But first, anything to say about the three who did get in?
These were all pretty straightforward and obvious choices. Based on his in-ring record and accomplishments, Floyd is the slam dunkiest of slam dunks.
Yeah.
Vladimir, I was among his fiercest critics in the boxing media, and I still say he is a no-brainer slam dunk Hall of Famer. And Andre Ward, maybe you can poke holes in his resume and find an excuse not to vote for him the first time around. He's a little less slam dunky than the other two, but he's still a slam dunk. He won the legit title in two divisions, reached number one pound for pound, won Olympic gold also for what that's worth, never officially lost, although one fight maybe he was lucky to get the decision, and he went out on top. So very easy votes there. And I voted for Cotto and Tony also, although I guess not enough of my fellow voters were on the same page as me. So, Mr. Mulvaney, the floor is yours. Grumble, if you wish, about your sweet, sweet baby Miguel Cotto not getting voted in.
Look, Miguel Cotto will be a Hall of Famer. I think he should have been a first ballot Hall of Famer. And I really would have, on a personal level, enjoyed him going in as a part of this amazing sort of double class. Depending on why he isn't there, I could get it, right? For all we know, Ward and Klitschko may have only just scraped 80% themselves or came short of 80%. Knowing the way that boxing writers vote, it's entirely possible. I could also get an argument if some voters were thinking, yeah, you know what? Mayweather, Klitschko, and Ward are clearly of the gold standard, and they should absolutely go in on the first ballot, but I want them to separate themselves. I'll do Cotto next year because he was very good. But up against the very best, up against Mayweather, up against Pacquiao, up against Canelo, he fell just short. It's like if Mike Messina was on the same ballot as Pedro Martinez and Randy Johnson and Roger Clemens, you're like, yeah, Mike Messina's a Hall of Famer, but so if that's the thinking, I kind of get it. And I've done that in the past with some guys that I thought, well, I think he could be a Hall of Famer, but this person is clearly so much better. I want them to have the stage to themselves, kind of a thing. So I hope that that's the reason he didn't reach 80%. It's not because I hope that boxing's hipster brigade thought it was important to virtue signal vote for, other Puerto Ricans who may have been on the ballot. I'm hoping it's because a lot of Cotto's votes went to, say, Rafael Marquez, who also totally should be in the Hall of Fame and deserves to get in there. But I hope you and I get to go to induction weekend in 2021 when there will be this amazing class. I hope we're also there in 2022 when Cotto and Tim Bradley or Rafa Marquez or Pong Selleck Won Jung Kam join Roy Jones Jr. in Canastota. That will be another good year to be there.
Yeah.
It will be a big year for women in the Hall of Fame, as several will be going in. Layla Ali and Ann Wolf joining 2020 holdovers Christy Martin and Lucia Riker in the Modern Fighter category. 1970s and 1980s pros Marianne Trimiar and the late Jackie Tonawanda in the Trailblazer category. And our good friend Dr. Margaret Goodman in the non-participant category. Very happy, especially for our friend Margaret, who's done so much for fighter safety, both with the Nevada Commission and with VADA. Big fans of both Layla Ali and Wolf. Very happy for them, too. I will say this, though. Two classes of modern fighters for women, and the inductees so far have all been American or very well known in America.
Yep.
I do wonder how many of those who voted for Ann Wolf could tell you much more about her career other than the right hand with which she poleaxed Von der Ward. meanwhile, Regina Hulmich, who retired with a professional record of 54-1-1, mm-hmm. and whose farewell fight was watched by 8 million people on TV in Germany, is still on the outside looking in. I don't have a vote for the women's category. So those of you who do, fix this. Regina Hulmich needs to go in the Hall of Fame.
Well, you commented on exactly what I wanted to comment on with the women.
Oh, okay.
That there is an American bias developing with this category. I do have a vote. This was the first time that I had a vote in the female category. And you will be pleased to know, Kieran, that I did vote for Regina Hulmich over Ann Wolf as my second choice this year, which is not to say Ann Wolf is not worthy.
Absolutely.
But I assume that this pro-American bias will eventually straighten itself out, hopefully sooner rather than later. And I just want to echo what you said about Dr. Margaret Goodman. Very happy for her. She used to write a column for The Ring when I was an editor there. She was an excellent guest on the old Ring Theory podcast one time. Perhaps we'll have her on this podcast as well at some point. But congratulations to Dr. Goodman. A few other names to run down in other categories. In the old-timer category, the Springfield Rifle Davey Moore will be inducted, and we have to include his nickname to distinguish him from boxing's various other Davey Moores. Two more non-participants in addition to Margaret. We have cutman Freddie Brown and manager/trainer Jackie McCoy. And in the observer category, writer George Kimball and former Showtime Boxing president Jay Larkin. And I want to say a little something about Jay because, I mean, I'd met George Kimball, but can't really say I knew him. But I did get to know Jay a little bit, and I really liked him. Met him in person just once, but interviewed him on the phone many times. And he just had a welcoming way about him. Never made you feel like he viewed it as a chore to talk to the press. Mm. It's hard to explain, but there was a certain warmth that I always felt from Jay. I particularly remember interviewing him for an article I wrote in 2007 on the 10th anniversary of the Bite Fight. And Jay had departed Showtime 2 years earlier, so he wasn't involved in boxing anymore. I believe he was doing something with MMA, but not boxing. And we just had a great conversation as he told a bunch of stories about that night in Las Vegas. It was just truly sad when he got sick and died fairly young, just 59, of a brain tumor. But he left behind a really important legacy at Showtime, guiding the sports division for 20 years. I've been voting for both Jay and Seth Abraham, formerly of HBO, mm-hmm. for the last couple of years. I thought it would be really cool if they got inducted together. That isn't happening, but I am thrilled that Jay Larkin is getting this posthumous honor. He belongs in Canastota.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think you brought that up maybe last year when we were talking about the Hall of Fame, that just how nice it would be if the two of them went in together. It's a shame they haven't But yeah, very happy in memory of Jayanne, indeed, for George, who, like yourself, I interacted with him a little bit, a couple of times, and he was as kind and generous with his time as could be. And obviously, of course, an absolutely fabulous writer. I'm going to continue also banging the drum in the Observer category for John Shepherd and Bob Canobio, respectively, the founder of BoxRec and co-founder of CompuBox. I can't think, really, of two Observers, non-fighters, who've had such a massive influence on the way people consume and think about boxing. They sort of affect all of us involved in boxing on a daily basis. I do hope that both of them at one point get in.
All right. I know you're fixing to wrap up the show here, Kieran, and wrap up our year. Yes, exactly. Before you do, though, just a quick word about the podcast as 2020 ends and 2021 is about to begin. This was a strange year for everyone, a difficult year for almost everyone. As we've remarked many times, lockdown impacted the two of us far less than it impacted most people. We're both built for this, at least in the short term. I've actually found myself fraying around the edges a bit as the year wore on. But anyway, I'm really glad we were able to keep doing this podcast throughout the pandemic. It was something I look forward to almost every week, and we had some fun with it, and I think did some of our best podcasts this year, just talking about TV shows we were binging and interviewing some first-time guests over Zoom and talking about how they were coping with the pandemic and all that. And of course, podcasting is a lot more enjoyable when you know people are actually going to hear it. So a thank you to all our listeners for their support. Hopefully we gave you guys a nice distraction from the living hell that was 2020. if you are a fan of the pod, and I assume you are if you've made it to the end of this episode, we don't ask for much, but one thing you can do to support the show is to write a review on Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating. I don't quite know why that stuff helps, but apparently it helps. So do that. It will help ensure we keep putting this free entertainment in your ear holes. As Kieran said at the top of the show, we'll be back next year, and we'll be trying a few new things, some new segments, new twists, shaking it up a bit without abandoning any of the mulviness and raskiness you've come to love. So before you say it, Kieran, I just want to say to our listeners, thank you for hanging out with us. Enjoy the holidays, and we're looking forward to a big 2021.
Yeah, one of the big changes that I certainly commit to make in 2021, as we hopefully slowly emerge from this pandemic, is I am going to commit to consider thinking about actually starting to wear clothes while doing this podcast.
And you've ruined it.
There it is.
And I'm asleep.
It is. But with what dreams? With what dreams that await you? Yeah, just to follow on. Look, I also want to, many thanks to you for your co-hostery over the last 12 months and beyond. And of course, thanks to Brian Daly for his continued support this year and into next year, and to Matt Ryle and Courtney Magg as well for everything that they do for us. Thanks to all our wonderful guests, from Joseph Parker to Brian Custer to Derek James to Joe Goosen, Danny Garcia, even Carl Frotch, and of course Mauro Ranallo, among so many others. It's been a wonderful year of guests. As Eric said, it would be nothing without you, the listeners. So thanks for being with us. Thanks for interacting with us on social media. It's been a horrible year. It's just been a horrible year. And I don't doubt for a second that almost all of you have had plenty else to think about other than what Eric and I think about Carlos Monzon series or fights. The fact that you have wanted to put some time aside to listen to us every week is fantastic. And I hope that we've been able to provide a little bit of an escape from the awfulness. For those of you who have been struggling, for those who are continuing to struggle, for those for whom the holiday season will be an extra burden, you are not alone. There is help. Reach out to friends and family. If you can't do that or don't want to do that, do visit NAMI.org. There are many options available to help. We got quite a few good responses when Mauro and I talked about mental illness the other week. I know it's important to a lot of you. You are not alone. And this year is very nearly over, I promise. I hope, we both hope, that you're able to make the most of this holiday season and what remains of this historically dreadful year. We shall return, as Eric mentioned, in 2021. Until then, please, be safe, be kind, and most of all, be well.